my daughter will be a senior next year, and this will be her last year. And she was really looking forward to playing it again one more year.
The Anchorage School District gets rid of girls' hockey. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, you're invited to dinner at the White House. Can you bring along wild-caught fish?
My husband then gets a call from the Secret Service saying, well, we need to come over and inspect your halibut.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast has degrees online to prepare students for leadership positions across Alaska. Information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast.
Work on the Susitna-Watonna Dam will go forward this summer, according to a spokesperson for the state agency tasked with the project. Emily Ford, public outreach liaison for the Alaska Energy Authority, says the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has given the okay to a dozen study plans that have been waiting for approval since February of this year.
And then this month, on April 1st, they approved the remaining studies. So it's a very significant milestone was achieved for Susitna-Watonna Hydro, because now FERC has officially approved all 58 studies for our environmental field effort.
According to Ford, 180 people will be in the field this year. The dam plan has raised concerns in the Talkeetna area, which is downriver from the project. Richard Leo heads the Coalition for the Susitna Dam Alternatives Board.
There were a number of problems with the studies that FERC approved, and FERC only approved them after recommending many modifications to those studies. What AEA is going to do in order to make those studies more effective is yet to be seen.
One of the concerns posed by Leo's group is the impact the dam is likely to have on salmon, which are a major source of sport fishing income. At this time, heavy equipment is being shipped north on the Alaska Railroad to be used to bulldoze an airstrip at the Stephen Lake Lodge. The remote fishing and hunting lodge will be the headquarters for the AEA personnel conducting the studies. John Madsen, owner of the lodge, says he has permits to drag the equipment overland to the site. He says work will begin tomorrow, but Mike Woods, a resident of Chase, says the plan took him and his neighbors by surprise. He says the terrain there is not suitable for heavy equipment.
There's been no plan to create an ice road. This is just adventure travel across the tundra to establish a road in what has been roadless areas. The permit specifies that they cannot touch ground. They can only be on snow travel. But if they are like disturbing the ground and the waterways leading into the Susitna in any way, that immediately violates their permit.
Wood says the equipment could leave permanent scars on the landscape because there isn't a protective layer of ice and snow. The Anchorage School District has opted to dissolve its girls' hockey program after 10 years, citing low participation numbers as the primary reason. APRN's Josh Edge has the story.
ASD's Supervisor of High School Education, Derek Hagler, says even though there is certainly interest in girls' hockey in Anchorage, the school program just wasn't sustainable.
The hope, and certainly the goal, was to grow that program so each high school could field a competitive team. As the numbers have not increased, and as the interest has not grown, as shown by the activity and athletic survey that ASD administers each year, it became necessary to look at discontinuing this program.
Hagler says 83 girls participate in high school hockey. He says even without the program, the district will still be in compliance with Title IX, which grants equal athletic opportunities to both men and women. This year, there are 16 girls' sports and 15 boys' sports in Anchorage High Schools, and last year, over half the athletes competing in high school sports were female. Brent Vandenbos has been the head coach of the Diamond West girls' hockey team for the past two seasons. He says he has a number of upset players who he has talked to over the last couple days, including his daughter.
My daughter will be a senior next year, and this will be her last year, And she was really looking forward to playing it again one more year. She played the last couple of years and really improved and enjoyed it.
Vandenbos has talked with parents as well, some of whom won't have a daughter in high school for the next year or two, but are still upset by the cancellation of the program.
That's what they were looking forward to, is going to watch the girls' high school hockey game and their team being on there. And, you know, high school is a pretty big thing up here.
Derek Hagler says even though the program is gone for now, the district will continue to reevaluate the situation, and if the interest level in girls' hockey rises in the future, the program could be reinstated. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Senator Lisa Murkowski and the rest of the women in the Senate had dinner at the White House last night. Dinner with the president is a big deal for just about anyone. But as APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the real story isn't about the discussion, but the contents of the dinner plates.
Women make up half the U.S. population, but just 20% of the Senate. So the relationships among female senators tend to be close, regardless of party. In fact, the women of the Senate gather regularly at one another's houses for dinner. Senator Murkowski told a gaggle of energy reporters she was slated to play host this week.
We were planning on serving halibut. So then on Monday, when we got the call saying that the president wanted to invite the women over to his house...
That would be the White House.
I said, well, wait a minute. We got halibut thawing for 16 people. What are we going
to
do?
She says she offered to take the fish to the White House. And to be fair, Murkowski explicitly says it was wild caught in Alaskan waters, though it's unclear whether she or her husband caught the fish. Turns out, you can't just bring fish into the White House, even if you are a United States senator. And security is especially tight these days, with a ricin-laced letter addressed to the president intercepted last week.
My husband then gets a call from the Secret Service saying, well, we need to come over and inspect your halibut.
That proved too much of a hassle, so the White House opted to buy its own Alaskan halibut. Murkowski says it turned out well. Sure, there were substantive things discussed at dinner, icebreakers, Arctic diplomacy, and energy, to name a few, but Murkowski clearly enjoyed explaining Alaskan fish and freezing to lower 48 reporters.
We start September off with a lot of fish. Yeah. This is the time of year that you're looking to move that halibut.
As for those 16 fillets, it's been confirmed they never completely thawed and are back in the freezer, safe for consumption. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Greenpeace is trying to coax would-be whistleblowers to come out against Arctic oil companies they may work for. The environmental group launches a website today called Arctic Truth. On it, workers are encouraged to anonymously tip off infractions.
We don't actually quite know what information we'll get.
Ben Aliff heads Greenpeace's Arctic oil campaign. He says there haven't been any responses yet, and it may take some time. He hopes workers all over the Arctic, not just Alaska, will emerge and expose risks the companies might be taking. He says information could come from anywhere, from workers offshore.
So the decision makers in say, Anchorage or in Houston, that have information that we think is interesting and relevant.
Spokespeople for Shell Alaska and ConocoPhillips had nothing to say about the latest attempt from Greenpeace to block their planned drilling campaigns. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Kodiak welcomes the first cruise ship of the season.
And so what are your impressions of Kodiak so far? And you can be honest.
Well, other than the rain, it's beautiful. It's lovely.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at Doyon.com.
Two native villages on Alaska's western coast are coping with shortages of treated water brought on by failures of their supply transmission pipelines. Unalakleet, a largely Inupiat Eskimo community, lost use of its main pipeline when it froze a month ago and developed leaks. Almost 300 miles to the north, Kivalina has imposed strict conservation measures all winter after its pipeline was damaged by late summer storms before the Inupiat community's water tanks could be completely filled. build. Unalakleet City Manager Scott Dickens says the pipeline has been cleared and patched. He says the village is now waiting for state regulators to clear samples of treated water as safe to drink. Kivalina City Manager Janet Mitchell says the village barely has enough water to last until tanks can be filled. The so-called Coastal Caucus has given some Alaska senators a louder voice in the lopsided Republican majority that favors the state's urban centers. Senator Dennis Egan is part of the group that's worked together in the past, but formalized its existence during the legislative session. KTOO's Rosemarie Alexander has the story.
It could have been worse.
Senator Dennis Egan took a big gamble this year. He's a lifelong Democrat who joined the Republican majority, top heavy with senators from Anchorage, Matsu, and the urban interior. It was not an easy decision, but he still thinks it was the right one.
You have to represent your community. Most of this stuff, as far as I'm concerned, is not an R&D thing. It's not politics. You know, it's the people that you represent.
Egan's Southeast Alaska District is no longer just Juneau, but Skagway, Tenneke Springs, Gustavus, and Petersburg. And Southeast lost representation in the redistricting process.
Believe me, because of redistricting, I consider ourselves rural Alaska.
Including Juneau. Egan says rural and coastal Alaska do not get enough attention in the legislature, hence the Coastal Caucus. It's chaired by Sitka Republican Bert Stedman, Kodiak Republican Gary Stevens, Western Alaska Democrat Donnie Olson, and Egan were leaders in the bipartisan coalition that ran the Senate in the 27th legislature, but they lost power in the new Republican-led majority. Freshman Senator Kenai Republican Peter Michicki has also joined the Coastal Caucus. With 5 of the 15 majority members, Egan says Coastal Caucus senators have gained some clout.
They now know we're a force.
They also take care of their own. Early in the session, a resolution calling for a constitutional amendment to allow state funding for religious and private schools was referred to the Senate Education Committee, chaired by Gary Stevens. On a day when Stevens was gone, Senate Republican leaders yanked the resolution from the committee.
I thought they rolled the chair.
He phoned Stevens, who had no idea the bill had been pulled from his committee.
He was elected by the caucus to be the chair of education. You don't pull an education bill out of his committee without the chair's consent.
Egan also voted against the move, which brought the threat of sanctions from Republican leaders. In the end, there were none, and it wasn't the last time he bucked the majority, which would prefer members vote as a block. 4 of 5 Coastal Caucus legislators voted against the bill to reduce oil industry taxes. Egan says too much was left on the table.
Tit for tat. You give us something, we give you something. As far as I'm concerned, we're giving a lot, but we're not getting much. I mean, there's no guarantee that they're going to drill or they're going to explore.
He's also upset that school districts did not get an increase in the base student allocation and is sorry his communities did not get more money for construction projects. But on the whole, he says, his newly expanded district did okay. The House and the bipartisan Coastal Caucus helped that.
Coastal Alaska senators felt we were being left out, and if we weren't part of that caucus, we wouldn't have had any voice. I think that would have been a true disaster.
Egan plans to visit his constituents in Petersburg and Skagway next month and is still working on arrangements for spring trips to Tenneke and Gustavus. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
An autopsy report confirms a Fairbanks man found on fire in a downtown post office died of burn injuries, but does not explain the origin of the flames that killed Johnny Wallace. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Johnny Wallace, a homeless man who drank and walked the streets of Fairbanks, did not smoke. Fairbanks Police Chief Laren Zager says the autopsy report from the King County Medical Examiner's Office in Seattle shows the cause of Wallace's death was thermal burns over 25% of the body, but the manner of death is a question.
It doesn't give us any any insights at all as to any suspicious circumstances, if any accelerants were used. It doesn't suggest one way or the other that this was either an accidental issue, intentional. Gives us no insights into the investigation at all.
The 59-year-old Wallace was found on fire in the lobby of the downtown post office on New Year's Day. A postal customer and firefighters extinguished the flames and got Wallace to the hospital. He died 4 days later at a Seattle burn unit before he could answer questions about what happened. Chief Zager says efforts to put out the fire and treat Wallace potentially affected determination of the fire's cause.
No one was doused in gasoline or any other accelerant, but if a trace amount, a small amount, for instance, of lighter fluid was used, a small butane lighter, that could very well have been, you know, consumed, covered, never to be recovered again as forensic evidence.
Additional analysis of evidence is being conducted in Seattle and by the State of Alaska Crime Lab, but Zager says the investigation is stalled. A cab driver reported seeing two unidentified men sleeping in the post office lobby shortly before the fire, but there's been minimal other information. Some suspect Wallace may have been targeted because he was Alaska native, homeless, or an alcoholic, but Zager says nothing points to a crime.
Public ashtray is right outside that area. There could have been cigarettes right out there. He could have been with someone who accidentally dropped a cigarette, you know, into the folds of his clothing. No conclusions have been drawn. And it's probably the worst way of handling any case is where you just shrug your shoulders and says, it happened, but we just don't know what happened. We want to do better than that.
Zager says resolution of how Wallace died largely rests with people coming forward with new information.
You know, even rumors at this point would be something to move forward on.
The Tanana Chiefs Conference has been pushing efforts to find out how Johnny Wallace died. TCC is holding an annual March of Remembrance for victims of unsolved murders on Friday. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Students at Sitka's Alternative High School have decided to confront the methamphetamine problem head-on, and they're encouraging the rest of the community to join them at an event in early May. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Paulette James is a junior at Pacific High School. She's been working since the beginning of the school year to understand meth and the particular risks of this addiction.
When you go in to look at the stories of meth and everything, they didn't know what it could do to the body. They didn't know that this is their life would completely turn over, that they'd lose their job, lose their family, and everything that they had that they cared about within, you know, months or a year.
Pacific High is tackling the meth problem by throwing light on it, first in a science class taught by Eric Mathis and then in a community engagement class taught by Mandy Summer. James and another student became interested in exploring the upside of meth recovery early in the school year with an event of some kind. That student left Pacific High, and James has decided to continue her efforts solo. She says talking about meth can be difficult, but the stakes are high.
This whole class has been really actually kind of, you know, really Debbie Downer, but when it comes to the positive side, it becomes a passion for the teachers and for myself, because there's people that we care about that are affected directly by meth, and we want to get that message out there before it affects all the people we care about and the community.
James and the other students in Pacific High's community engagement class have organized an event in early May at Sitka's Crescent Harbor. It's called Got Resiliency. They're planning a performance by the Gajaheen Dancers, a film screening, and a concert by local musicians, including Silver Jackson. Resiliency means that there is a way to resist meth and support to find your way back.
The biggest message that we want to get out there is that, you know, we care and that you have value, that things may be rough, but you can always bounce back. There's always something you can do better for yourself, and that you don't need to turn to drugs or alcohol, because we have resources that if you need them, we can help you find them.
This entire Pacific High program, the science class, the community engagement class, and the Got Resiliency event are not a project of any government agency, nor are they the result of any grant funding. The initiative for the project came from within, from Pacific High's students and faculty. Hillary Sealand, another teacher at the school, says we'd identified that meth was becoming an issue and decided to face it head on. Reporting in Sitka with help from Holly Keene, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Cruise ship season has officially kicked off in Kodiak. The Crystal Symphony called on Alaska's Emerald Isle early yesterday morning and brought with it 480 passengers and 550 crew members. Despite the rain, hundreds of tourists were able to explore the downtown area. KMXT's Brianna Gibbs caught up with some of them and filed this report.
Welcome to Kodiak. Where are you folks coming from?
We're from California.
I caught up with Toni Bowder and her husband Ed while they were taking shelter from the rain in downtown Kodiak. After a long, wet morning, walking around in the island's not-so-uncommon rainfall, the couple was happy to chat.
And so what are your impressions of Kodiak so far? And you can be honest.
Well, other than the rain, it's beautiful. It's lovely.
It was the pair's first time in Kodiak, and Ed was all about the Eagles.
Well, like I'm out for these bald eagles taking pictures, so we were outside and we caught a couple in a tree, but they were kind of wet and they weren't going to do much. They weren't going to fly or anything. I don't think they could with how wet their feathers were, but I did take some pretty good pictures.
Toni said her favorite part of the day was visiting the Kodiak Wildlife Refuge Visitor Center.
It had the whole skeleton of the gray whale on the ceiling, and that was fascinating. And then the video of the Kodiak bears, and that was very interesting, and the people were so friendly.
Pamela and Charlie Montgomery from Vancouver, Canada, were also impressed by the whale skeleton.
Look at that. That's quite amazing, isn't it, to see that?
A short drive back to the cruise terminal brought me to Jim O'Connor, the ship's shore excursion manager. In between helping passengers onto various tour buses, O'Connor, who was originally from Melbourne, Australia, said the Crystal Symphony began its voyage in Los Angeles in early December.
We have some that have started back in Auckland, maybe in January, been on for a couple of months. Majority, though, are two-week cruises that continually move, and sometimes some guests will stay on for double cruises for a month or so on.
As for Alaska, the ship arrived in Kodiak from Dutch Harbor and will sail for Seward and Ketchikan next, which means plenty more opportunities for Ed Bowder to photograph eagles.
Probably get some fish that they'll go for, and I'll go for them, okay?
In Kodiak, I'm Brianna Gibbs.
Alex Will, a graduate student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, calls herself a ninja of the night, but it has nothing to do with martial arts. Will is a biologist who studies the foraging behavior of the rhinoceros auklet, a seabird which returns to land only once every 24 hours during Alaska's short summer nights. Despite climate change, receding ice pack, ocean acidification, and other environmental pressures on Arctic species, the rhinoceros auklet, or rhino for short, is thriving. And Will is determined to discover why. She spent 2 months last summer on a storm-battered mound of volcanic rock 10 miles out in Sitka Sound called St. Lazarus Island. Will captured and tagged rhinos to gather data on their movements at sea and collected feathers to analyze their physiology. Although it was not part of her research, Will also captured sounds as thousands of nesting pairs of rhinos and other birds descended on St. Lazaria every evening. She sent this audio postcard.
So the way the night goes on the island, it starts off and the rhinos come in right at dusk. One of the recordings has gulls in the background, and so you're hearing these really obnoxious gulls, really loud. The really low mooing is the rhinos as they start to come in, and I think there's a couple crashes that happen too. And there'll be this really short period of time where they'll be mooing in kind of these waves where they are really excited about getting back and either are just standing around mooing or they'll also moo when they get into their burrow. They pretty quickly get drowned out by storm petrels, so that's the ones that go doo-doo-doo-doo and are squawking. And then usually about an hour before dawn, the rhinos start coming out of their burrows and socializing, and that's when they really start mooing. And that one is where you have really, really, really loud mooing, and then there's a couple hootalootus tossed in there from the storm petrels. That's my favorite time of night, is when I can make it to right before dawn, because they get out, and then as the light starts coming back, the petrels die down, and then it's just these waves of these moos that kind of sweep across the whole colony. All these seabirds, while they aren't adapted to terrestrial life at all, and some of them, murres are a really good example. They're, you know, on the cusp of being completely marine. You know, they incubate their eggs for like 30 days, raise a chick in about 2 weeks, and then they're back to the ocean. Rhinos have a lot longer time on land, but all that said, it's the most important part of their life cycle, right? Because that's when they're passing on their genes to the next generation. I just need a bird that has fish so that I know it's a breeder, but I don't need to catch it again. I just need it for that one sample. And then for the fledglings, most of them I catch with a sort of a small landing net, but I have managed to grab a couple. As long as you sneak up on them, they're pretty clueless. You know, they're wandering around kind of very new to the world, I guess. And so you'll see them just kind of wandering back and forth, and if you startle them, they'll disappear, but as long as you can sneak up on them, they're not as quick as the adults are.
Alexis Will is a biologist pursuing her master's degree from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She plans to spend another summer on St. Lazaria this year. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Brianna Gibbs in Kodiak. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. The Alaska Energy Authority encourages you to renovate right this spring. Alaskans spend up to 50% of their income on energy. For energy-saving tips, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association. The Master of Public Administration at the University of Alaska Southeast is building a network of public administrators across Alaska and the Yukon Territory. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.